Jeff Cooper, RFA's Vice President of Research and Analysis, and his panel.
Well, good morning. I'd like to ask my fellow panelists to join me up here on stage, and I see they're all making their way up, so I'll offer a few comments in the meantime. As you just heard from Bob and heard earlier from Neil McKinstray, protecting and defending the RFS is the ethanol industry's highest priority in 2013. As Bob indicated, we expect a battle unlike any that the industry has ever seen over the RFS this year, and indeed that battle has already begun. So because of these dynamics, we thought it was important to dedicate a longer session specifically to the RFS, its past, its present, and its future. And we thought it was very important to hear from several major stakeholder groups who are affected in some way by the RFS and to gain a better understanding of those groups' perspective on the program. But before we hear from our other panelists, I wanted to take a few minutes to provide some context for the discussion and to give a bit of RFA's perspective on the RFS program. And this may seem somewhat remedial or kind of 101, but I thought it was very important to get back to the basics and kind of go back to the beginning and reemphasize why we're doing an RFS in the first place, why the program exists today. I think in recent months and indeed in recent years, we've really gotten bogged down in discussions and debates about things like biodiesel RIN fraud and cellulosic biofuel waiver credits and kind of the finer points of the program. And because of that, it's easy to lose sight of the bigger picture and forget why this program was established in the first place. And obviously, the reasons are the same today that they were back in 2005 and 2007. The point of the RFS is to diversify the transportation fuels portfolio here in the United States with a particular emphasis on reducing imports of fossil fuels, and along with that, to reduce pressure on fuel prices. Another purpose or another policy objective of the RFS was to stimulate economic development, particularly in rural areas, and enhance farm income. And then finally, which was more a feature of the RFS 2, the expanded program, the purpose or a policy objective was to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And I guess I would just pose a rhetorical question of, are these policy objectives any less important today than they were when RFS 1 and RFS 2 were established? Again, listening to the debate that we hear today, you would get the sense, and looking at some positions that some groups have taken on the RFS, you'd get the sense those positions would seem to suggest that these goals are no longer important or somehow have been met already. And we certainly disagree with that. I also wanted to remind everyone that the RFS is essentially a 15-year energy plan, and that we're already on year six of that plan. We're 40% of the way through the RFS 2. And I think it's important to point out that we've gotten here with really with no major hiccups, no big disasters. The program has worked very effectively, very efficiently, and I also think it's important to point out that the volumetric requirements of the program, as established by EPA annually through their RVO rulemaking, those requirements have been met each and every year. So when you stop to take stock of how we're doing and kind of look at the report card 6 years in, I think we have quite an impressive record and quite a good story to tell, and you heard much of that story from Bob just a few minutes ago. When you match up those policy objectives that I showed on the first slide with what's actually occurred over the last 5 to 6 years, you see that there's some very good alignment here. With the objective of diversifying the fuels portfolio, ethanol is now 10% of the gasoline pool. We have legal approval to move forward with E15, and we're beginning to see that. Biodiesel is being used in unprecedented quantities in the diesel pool. So that goal of diversifying the fuel pool, we certainly are making tremendous strides there. Reducing imports. Again, Bob showed the chart showing that we've gone from 60% dependence on imported oil and petroleum products down to 41% in 2012. Our imports from OPEC are down by a quarter since RFS2 was enacted in 2007. The economic development or economic rural development policy objectives, you know, we're creating over $40 billion in GDP, and much of that is being generated in rural America. Bob showed the jobs numbers. We're responsible for some 400,000 jobs directly and indirectly. In terms of farm income, we've absolutely seen tremendous success in farm income in recent years since the RFS was enacted. We saw record farm income last year, and government payments to farmers have reached extremely low levels. Those payments that are based on crop prices have essentially been zeroed out. And then finally, on the policy objective of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, CO2 emissions from transportation or from gasoline and diesel combustion are at their lowest level since 2002. And that's not just because we're driving less. That's largely because we're driving less. But if you look at vehicle miles traveled versus CO2 emissions, CO2 emissions are falling faster than VMT, and EIA credits much of that to increased use of biofuels. So again, as Bob said, you know, the RFS can't claim all the credit for these developments over the past several years, but it has been a tremendous catalyst in making these goals achievable. This chart just shows again that relative to the RFS requirements, ethanol production has always surpassed the volumetric requirements of the policy. The blue bars are actual ethanol production. The green line is RFS1 requirements, and then the red line you see at the top is the RFS2 annual requirements for renewable fuel or conventional biofuel. And again, we have surpassed those requirements each and every year, with the possible exception of 2012. The final numbers aren't in yet. It's likely that we may be a bit short of that 13.2 billion gallon requirement. But again, because of the overcompliance in the past several years, a substantial bank of surplus RIN credits has been accumulated, and those allowed easy compliance with 2012 requirements. So after this year, we have 9 years left for the RFS2 schedule. And, you know, as Bob indicated, some would prefer to pack up and go home and end the program today. It's starting to get tougher. Changes are beginning to be made, significant changes. The status quo isn't working anymore. And we obviously think that would be a tremendous mistake. And here are some of the major reasons why. Just a few weeks ago, a group at Oak Ridge National Laboratory published a paper in an academic journal called Biofuels. And it essentially examined the economic impacts of the RFS2 kind of to date, through the first 14 or 15 billion gallons, and then looked at the economic impacts of the overall program in 2022. And what they found was that the program provides substantial economic benefits, not just in the U.S., but globally. The RFS, they found, increases U.S. GDP by 0.8% by 2022. And that sounds like a small percentage, sounds like a small number, but when you consider that our GDP is $15 trillion, nearly 1% of that is a big number. They also found that most of that stems from the fact that fossil energy prices decline and oil imports are reduced. They also found that the impacts on commodity prices, agricultural commodities, isn't nearly as severe as some would lead us to believe. Their modeling found that commodity prices might increase less than 1% under the RFS2. They also found land use only changes very slightly in the United States, and that any increases in agricultural land use here in the U.S. are offset by declines in the rest of the world. And then finally, at the bottom there is kind of how they summed up their findings. They said the transition to advanced biofuels is crucial to keeping the momentum of the biofuels industry moving forward. This just graphically shows some of the results from that study, and I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but obviously what they're showing, the bar that is furthest on your right there is the world crude oil price, and they show that by 2015, 2014, kind of halfway through the program, a 3% world oil price reduction, and by 2022, a 7% reduction. And again, that may not seem like much, but when you consider the scale of the global oil market and hundreds of billions or trillions of dollars that are spent on crude oil, those are some significant numbers. You know, Bob mentioned that 2013 is going to be a critical year for the RFS. For the first time ever, the requirements of the program are going to exceed the blend wall. And the regulated community is going to have to change the way it does business. And I think that's why we're seeing this debate or this fight over the RFS really come to a head and manifest itself this year. And that's why, as Bob stated, protecting and defending and continuing to push this program forward is our top priority. You know, I want to close my comments with just a reminder that nobody said this was going to be easy. Nobody said it wouldn't require significant changes in the way our fuel market works. And in fact, that was the point of the RFS. It was intended to be transformational, and it was intended to be disruptive. So, you know, some stakeholder groups have suggested that this is just getting too hard and we just should stop this thing and stop trying. You know, again, the point is we are creating a major shift in the way the U.S. fuel market works. And that type of change doesn't come easy. It involves growing pains and bumps and bruises along the way. But the end result, as I think is highlighted well by the Oak Ridge study, the economic and environmental benefits of staying on the course are just too important and too significant to abandon the ship now. So that's why RFA believes, as Bob and Neil indicated earlier, that we absolutely must stay the course on the RFS as it was designed. So in a nutshell, that's RFA's view or perspective on the RFS2. But more importantly, I want to get to the other panelists and allow them to provide their perspectives, because there are lots of other groups and industries that have a stake in the RFS, and we need to hear from them, and we obviously need to continue working with them to implement this program in a successful manner. So I'm really pleased with the panel that we were able to put together this morning to provide some of those other perspectives. We're going to hear from my former boss, Rick Tolman, from NCGA with the ag perspective on the RFS. We're going to hear from John Reese with Shell, who I've had the pleasure of getting to know as we both served on the California LCFS advisory panel. And then we're going to hear from my good friend Brooke Coleman, executive director of the Advanced Ethanol Council, giving the advanced biofuels perspective. And then finally, we're going to hear from the investment community about where the investors are on the RFS and what they think the future might look like for the program, and that's going to be presented by Mark McMenemy. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Rick Tolman.
Thank you, Jeff. Jeff is one of my favorite people, and I think not only did Jeff used to work for us, but Samantha Slater, and I think those two are two of the largest contributions NCGA has ever made to the biofuels industry. And Bob, I want to remind you, when Jeff worked for me, he had a full head of hair. So I think all of us that are football fans were not working here, Jeff. Let's see. This one? Where do I point it? Okay. took a little bit of twinge. If you watch the Redskins Dallas game where RG3 twisted his knee and was taken out of the game, and later he had to have some knee surgery. In particular, I hate to watch those kinds of things. When I was a senior in high school, I dislocated my knee, and bottom part was pointing this way, the top part pointing that way, and the kneecap was on top. And it's happened several times since. I've had a number of knee surgeries, and very, very sensitive about watching people's knee injuries. And it's impacted the things that I can do and can't do. A lot of things I can't do anymore, like running. I love to mountain bike. I love to hike. I can still do those kinds of things. But also, my knee's become kind of ugly. It's got scars on it from surgeries. It's got some arthritis. I can't straighten it out. And I was looking on the internet for an ugly knee picture to put in this presentation, and I came across a website that's all about celebrities and ugly knees. And this goes to prove that you can find anything on the internet. And after seeing that, I felt a lot better because I'm in pretty good company. So I'm going to talk more about knees in a minute and explain why I even brought that up, but just hang on to that thought for a minute. So Jeff asked me to address four questions: our view, NCGA's view on the success of the RFS to date, the importance of preserving the program, the implementation challenges, the implementation opportunities, the pathways to get the 36 billion gallons, and then what's the future role of corn in the RFS? So let me address those directly. Success of the RFS to date, we think it's been very successful. It's a great American success story. It's reduced our dependence on imported oil. It's made positive contributions to our GDP. You've seen a lot of facts and figures. We sustain those, support those. In fact, recently, the Missouri corn growers and the University of Missouri FAPRI did a study, looked at the impact of the RFS just on my home state of Missouri and showed that it had a $12 billion economic impact on just the state of Missouri, a $50 billion increase in labor income, $2.2 billion in-state and federal taxes. So it's a huge success story. The positives far outweigh the negatives. So we're very supportive, very pleased with it, and very happy with what it's accomplished. How do we feel about preserving the program? Early last month, we do something in the corn growers. We pull our states together, and we do what we call our priority and policy conference. And we ask the states to tell us what are the priorities they have for NCGA for the coming year. And without any peer from the states, we heard preserve the RFS more often than any other comment. It's the single biggest mention in our conference. So for sure, we're strongly and staunchly behind don't mess with the RFS. We want to preserve the gains, we want to build on the foundation. It's the basis for some certainty, and it keeps U.S. commitments to the renewable fuels industry. So we're strongly behind that. Third question, what do we think are the implementation opportunities? Well, certainly it helps to stimulate infrastructure development. It's going to push us to address that blend wall. It's doing that. It keeps the oil industry engaged in a way that they might not otherwise do so. It's stimulating us to look at some creative ways to do things, and it keeps a floor in the market to some degree. What are the implementation challenges? And I think those have been brought up this morning also. From our perspective, there are a range of things that may or may not be true, but they're things we're going to have to address and be prepared for. The implementation schedule has some intricacies to it, some unique features. We all know about the blend wall, and certainly there's a lot of talk about the changing U.S. market structure dynamics. Let me address those just a little bit each individually. You've seen this slide. This is a little different. The renewable fuel standard has certain elements to it that are complexities in the way it has to be fulfilled. Certainly, filling the buckets going forward are going to be a little more complicated than they have going backward. It has some unique things in terms of advanced biofuels. There are some perhaps perverse incentives for things like Brazilian imported ethanol. Bob's referenced that. So those are going to be challenges to deal with a little more so than they have been in the past going forward. And certainly corn ethanol, corn starch ethanol is capped at 15 billion gallons. And to us, that's a challenge. That's to look at going forward. We have heard a lot about this situation, the cellulosic mandates versus reality. We're going to hear more about it. And the facts are that so far there have been no cellulosic gallons go against the RFS, and it's something we're going to have to continue to work on. It's not unachievable, and there's progress being made, but we're going to hear more about that, and that's a challenge that we have to be able to address. Certainly the realities of the marketplace seem to be changing slightly, and how much is up to some opinion. But we're hearing more about the realities of how big the marketplace is since the renewable fuel standard was put in place. That was the projection, the red line of market growth, total gasoline market growth in the U.S. when it was put in place. This is a recent EIA estimate, and this is even a more recent one, showing that we're using less fuel than we had we had projected to use, and that certainly has implications for the blend wall and what we're going to go forward with. We need to be prepared for that. And as Bob and Jeff mentioned, there's a lot of talk about the U.S. becoming a larger producer of oil. According to DOE, we will become the second largest producer in 2013. A lot of projections that are very optimistic, a lot of talk being made about that, and something we need to be able to address as we go forward. So we have the combination of perhaps an increasing domestic oil production and declining marketplace, which is a little different set of dynamics than when the renewable fuel standard was first put in place. And if you look at what the American Petroleum Institute estimates, they're showing a future that keeps biofuels at about 10% and increases our domestic production to 72%. So they have very optimistic projections out there. And again, we need to be aware of those and be able to address those. Those are challenges. Well, the fourth question Jeff asked me to address, what are the pathways to getting to 36 billion gallons by 2022? Back in April of 2011, a document was published called the Ethanol Roadmap. This was put together over the winter of 2010, and you can see signing that were the American Coalition for Ethanol, the National Corn Growers, Growth Energy, and the Renewable Fuels Association. At the time that was put together, there were some that suggested that this was deserving of the Nobel Peace Prize to get all four groups to be signed onto that document. Fortunately, things are in a better state now, but there are some elements of that report that we think are still very viable. Talk about expanding consumer fuel choice with more infrastructure being available, flex fuel vehicles. This document also talks about empowering consumers to have choice with blender pumps. We also, in that document, talk about ensuring feedstock neutrality in measures against advanced biofuels, and also being able to take advantage of ethanol's unique characteristics and its octane value in future engines. I think all those things, from our perspective, are still irrelevant as we look at how to get to 36 billion gallons by 2022. And finally, Jeff asked me to address the future role of corn in the renewable fuel standard. Well, you're all aware that corn starch ethanol is capped at 15 billion gallons after 2015. And so that, to some degree, seems to limit our ability going forward. We know that there are opportunities for corn to participate in cellulosic ethanol with some of the corn stalks, corn cobs, other kinds of things. We have a pathway looking at perhaps for corn fiber to become an advanced biofuel pending before EPA right now. But for us, I think most important thing that we can do going forward in the RFS, job one, is to produce a big crop in 2013. And let me just talk a little bit about that, because that's so significant, I think, to your industry and our industry. It's the thing that we face if we need to get back to a position of strength in being able to have the supplies and the stocks and the productive capability available and focused to the consumers that we've had in the past. Let me recap a little bit about the 2012 drought. If you look historically, you can see the declines that we've had going back. We talk about the 1988 drought and the different percentages. The reality is the drought we had in 2012 had a much bigger impact because it was off a higher base. And when you take a percentage of 150 to 160 bushels and cut that by 20-some percent, that's a lot larger number of bushels than it was in 1988. So it was a huge impact. When you look at the impact on yield, you can see by different states, it was very different. Kentucky, Ohio, Indiana, Missouri were the hardest hit states, and they had significant declines, percentage declines off trend yields. The Eastern Corn Belt was hit very, very hard in this drought. North Dakota, Minnesota did quite well comparatively, and the other corn-producing states were off to a greater degree than those states, but not as much as the Eastern Corn Belt. If you compare the drought map in July of last year with January, you can see that there's good news and bad news. The good news is the Eastern Corn Belt is doing much better than it was last year. In fact, to some degree, parts of the Eastern Corn Belt can be considered out of the drought. The bad news is the Western Corn Belt, the drought has intensified. Nebraska, Kansas, Colorado, things are much worse and very, very crucial going forward. If you look at the projected winter precipitation chart, there's not a lot of optimism there. The green areas are areas that are projected to get higher than the average precipitation. The ones in the brown are the less. Winter's not over. We can still get out of this, but it's something that we need to continue to watch, and we need to have a particular focus on the Western Corn Belt. There's already been some projections out about the crop for 2013, Informa and ProExporter. They're very optimistic in their projections. Both are projecting a modern time record in the number of acres that we'd plant. They're up around 98, 99 million acres, which is very, very significant. ProExport is looking at an almost complete rebound and looking at getting back to trend line yields, which would leave us with over 1.6 billion bushel carryout by the end of the year. And I just see they updated this recently. They're showing over 2 billion bushel carryout by the end of the year. Prices back down to $5. Significant amounts rebound in exports. The reality is, with normal weather, we can outproduce the market very easily. There's no question about that. And whether it's this year or next year, we will be back to surplus positions again with corn production. The reality is that we need to get back there now. So let me get back to my knee. And this is me speaking, not the National Corn Growers. This is my opinion. I consider the RFS a lot like my left knee. My left knee has served me very well. It has some flaws. So far I've been able to get over those and do quite well. It's functional. There's a little bit of drop off. I still have some difficulties. It's declining each day, each week, each month. But I've been told that I need to have it replaced. That's the next thing that needs to happen. But it's mine, and I don't want to give it up. I've lived with it. I can handle it. The positives far outweigh the negatives, and for right now, I want to keep it at all costs. I may change my mind sometime in the future, but for now, it's mine. I want to keep it, and the positives far outweigh the negatives. So I agree with Bob. Don't mess with the RFS, and don't mess with my left knee. Thank you very much.
Remote disappeared on us. I should have mentioned that we're going to hold all questions until the end. We're going to allow each panelist to give their prepared remarks, and then I'll pose a few questions for the panel, and then we'll open it up to your questions. But next, we're going to hear from John Reese with Shell.
Thank you so much. Good morning. Thank you so much for inviting me here today. It's nice to look around the room, and I see folks that I go back to on the RFS from the very first days. Bob Dineen and I worked together on the original RFS in D.C. back in 2000, 2001 and 2, and I see Chris over here too. So a lot of us go back a long ways with this RFS. I've been working on fuels issues since 1991. That's 21 years. 10 of it in D.C., and then I went and I joined Shell about 10 years ago. But I've been involved with the RFS from the beginning. I'm the guy that writes Shell's comments on EPA proposed rules, so on the RFS 1 and RFS 2. I had a lot to do with kind of the original structure of the RFS as it went through Congress back in the early days. I figure I know just about as much about the RFS program at this point as anybody. I want to talk about a few things today. I want to give you a little background on Shell and biofuels, the role of ethanol today, some successes and challenges of the RFS thus far, and then finally and most importantly, the challenges going forward. And there it's the blend wall. I think it's important that we all understand the blend wall problem. I'm concerned that as I talk to people about the blend wall, and I've been talking to folks about it for a long time, a lot of folks don't understand what the blend wall means. And I even see analysts publish their analysis, and I think they tend to get it about half right. And so I think there's a misunderstanding of what the problem is, and I think we all need to understand the problem so that we can work on solutions. Shell and biofuels. We're one of the world's largest distributor of biofuels. We've been a key enabler of the use of ethanol and other biofuels here in the United States. Back when California was phasing out MTBE in the early 2000s, we kind of pioneered the unit train concept and the ethanol hub concept to cost-effectively transport ethanol from the Midwest into California. And then with our joint venture, Motiva, we replicated that, and we really facilitated the movement of ethanol into the Northeast when they were moving out of MTBE, and we bring unit trains into the New York Harbor area and have an ethanol hub operation there. And we've done the same thing down in Atlanta as well. So, you know, we're proud of that we have been an enabler and of ethanol in blending into gasoline thus far in the United States. We're also involved in ethanol production. We have a joint venture that produces ethanol. And we're interested in trying to work forward on the advanced biofuels, the cellulosic biofuels. We have a biofuels pilot plant in Texas where we're exploring the production of drop-in biofuels, including drop-in gasoline and diesel. These would be biogasoline and biodiesel, using a range of feedstocks, starting with sugars, but also looking at other non-food cellulosic feedstocks. We support the general structure of the RFS, but we believe that the mandates must be changed to ensure that they're in line with the capabilities of vehicles and infrastructure to use the biofuels. I wish I had a nice little story like his left knee. I guess my knees must be a little bit worse shape than yours because, you know, I'm kind of at the point on the RFS that we support the structure, but we do think it needs to be revised because we see issues coming up in the future. You know, we also think it'd be good if the law provided additional incentives to encourage cellulosic drop-in biofuels, to encourage their commercialization. They, you know, ultimately are a solution to the blend wall problems. Now, a little bit about the role of ethanol now from our perspective. Almost all of the gasoline in the U.S. now is E10, and that would likely continue whether there was a mandate or not at this point. You know, we've come to rely on ethanol for octane. Pipeline specs rely on ethanol. You know, companies have contracts for ethanol. And then there's technical issues that make it difficult to switch in and out of ethanol, things like the RVP waiver for ethanol blends. And, you know, it's especially true when the economics of ethanol are favorable that, you know, there's a strong incentive to blend ethanol. But E15 and E85 have been slow to expand, and I think there's a few good reasons for that. We think that, you know, Shell thinks that EPA was premature approving the use of E15 for 2001 in newer vehicles. The automobile manufacturers have stated that they would not warrant the use of E15 in their cars, with the exception of a couple manufacturers talking about this year Ford, but the issue is last year back. And then there's also the CRC tests that have recently raised concerns around E15. And there's a whole panel on that tomorrow, and that panel will get into the details on that. But I did want to point out that, you know, that's Shell's view, that we think that EPA was premature approving E15. You know, our view is that it's only compatible with the vehicles that were designed to use it, which is about 5% of the vehicles on the road, the flexible fuel vehicles that are also compatible with the use of E85. Another issue with both E15 and E85 is something about the structure of our industry that I think is not very well understood. 97% of all retail gasoline stations are independently owned and operated. And 60% of those stations are owned by sole proprietors. The major oil companies generally do not own the retail gasoline stations. So when it comes to the big investment, and it is a big investment at our individual retail site, to either upgrade to an E15 fuel or an E85 fuel, it's really that independent small business person who would have the decision to do that. And these are big investments for those folks, somewhere in the order of $40,000 to $200,000, depending on, you know, what has to be changed. And then, of course, E85 has the additional challenge of, you know, the mileage discount relative to gasoline. Vehicles operating on E85 get about 25-30% fewer miles than gasoline. And so, you know, that causes E85 to be economically challenged. Now, moving on to the RFS implementation so far it really has been pretty smooth, but there's been a few issues. The RFS has prompted investments in ethanol production, distribution, and blending. Like I say, almost all gasoline in the U.S. is now blended with 10% ethanol. It's also prompted investments in the cellulosic next-generation biofuels. EPA just came out with their RVOs for 2013. I understand that there was some cellulosic actually produced in 2012, and they expect more to be produced in 2013. Plants are actually coming online. But there also have been some challenges for the RFS. And, you know, from my perspective, the fraudulent RIN issue was a big issue. You know, it undermined confidence in the whole RIN system. But EPA just last week issued a proposal to address that problem. It's basically a RIN validation program. And Shell was an early supporter of that concept. We still need to look at the details. You know, the devil's sometimes in the details. But as a general concept, we think that's a good idea. And then, of course, the cellulosic has been slow to develop, well behind the schedules, you know, in the law. I don't think that's a surprise. You know, the law actually had mechanisms to adjust for that. But the way that EPA handled that, I think, brought unnecessary criticism onto that provision and onto the program by setting it not just at the cellulosic levels at what they thought would be produced, but then inflating that some as well. And they were handed a defeat in court just last week for doing that. I think what the court told EPA is that going forward, they need to be more realistic when setting those cellulosic mandates. And I think that's good for the program, really, because this EPA setting it on realistically high levels really brought down a lot of criticism on the program, you know, for what purpose. But the big issue going forward is the blend wall issue. And you know, one of my colleagues at Shell asked me, you know, he said, John, you know, you're going to go to this conference and, you know, explain to them the blend wall, and you're, you know, going to have to explain. They got it half right, I think. They said, you know, because of the blend wall, there's not going to be adequate consumption of the renewable fuels as required by the mandates, and then that's going to result in, you know, a shortfall of RINs, basically. And then obligated parties are going to have to pay big penalties to EPA. From my perspective, that is an incorrect analysis, because what that analysis suggests is that obligated parties are going to violate the law and then just pay penalties to EPA. That's not what's going to happen. Okay, that's from my perspective, that's not what's going to happen. We don't knowingly violate the law and then just pay penalties to EPA. What we're going to do is comply with the law. And that's the problem with the blend wall. Now, let me explain a little bit more. And here what I'm doing is just explaining to you how EPA's regulations work, okay? How the law works and how EPA's regulations work. But what those regulations do is that is basically, as we hit the blend wall, it limits the supply of gasoline and diesel fuel for U.S. consumption. So for every gallon of gasoline and diesel fuel that an obligated party either produces or imports for U.S. consumption, we incur an obligation under each one of those four buckets of the RFS: cellulosic, biomass-based diesel, advanced, and general renewable. We can only legally produce or import for U.S. consumption as much gasoline and diesel fuel as we have RINs to meet those obligations we incur. So that's the job of an obligated party, is to acquire enough of the different kinds of RINs to meet that obligation. Unfortunately, though, as the renewable fuel mandates escalate, the RINs are likely to become in short supply, because the availability of RINs is not based on the production of the biofuels. The availability of the RINs for compliance is based on the consumption of the biofuels in the United States, basically in transportation fuels, with a couple exceptions, heating oil and jet, et cetera. But it's got to be consumed, okay? So the problem with the blend wall is that the mandated volumes exceed the ability of the infrastructure and the vehicles to absorb and consume the renewable fuels, resulting in a shortfall in RINs, which then limits the supply of gasoline and diesel fuel to U.S. consumers, as if this plays out without being addressed. And I think here again, I'll emphasize something about the structure of our industry. It's important to understand that, you know, 97% of all retail gasoline stations are independently owned and operated. And these are big investments. And those parties are not obligated parties. They are not obligated under the RFS in any way. They'll only make those investments to the extent that it makes business sense for them to do that. All right, so I hope I've adequately explained to you here why I'm worried about the RFS, okay, and why I think that it needs to be fixed. Over the course of the last 5 years or so, I've explained this and tried to explain it to a lot of people, and I've lost a bit of sleep on this. So what needs to be done to fix this? The problem with the blend wall has to be fixed before it adversely affects consumers and the economies. We believe the mandates have to be revised to be consistent with the capabilities of the infrastructure and the vehicles to use the fuel. We think this is important to the overall preservation of the program. And remember, Shell generally supports the RFS. We have an interest in production of biofuels now. We have an interest in cellulosic biofuels going forward. But we understand the consequences of the blend wall, and we think that they need to be addressed. And let me just close by saying that we're interested in working with other stakeholders to address this problem before, you know, it becomes a problem for, you know, the folks here in America. So thank you very much.
Who's not serious? Do I see a presentation? How's it work? It's going to come up. Okay, there it goes. Hi, I'm Brooke Coleman, Executive Director of the Advanced Ethanol Council. I appreciate the opportunity to speak today. We put together the AEC a couple of years ago to unify and elevate the voice of the Advanced Ethanol Council. We joined with RFA. We enjoy a very productive relationship with RFA, and so thank you, Jeff, for giving us an opportunity to talk. I am catching on to a pattern here. It seems like over the last 10 years I talk after the oil guy. So I will continue to do that. I'm going to do a couple things today. First is I want to tell you a story that I think properly frames where we are, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about the RFS. And for those of you who have heard me talk about this story before, I'm actually doing this for you. So next year I don't have to ask you if I've already told you this story. I'm just going to tell the whole industry this story. So the story is, we have a messaging problem. We are getting hammered by the oil industry. I think everybody knows that. About 5 years ago, I decided I'd help my dad fix his boat, and I got out of work early on a Monday, October day. Shot down there and ripped off the distributor cap and took out all the spark plugs and tried to get all the cylinders firing, because all summer long this boat wasn't firing, it wasn't going fast enough, and wasn't a lot of fun. And of course, I got out of work late. It was 55 degrees when I got down there, and I started in a T-shirt, and I started to run up against that early sunset. Temperatures started to drop. I had my tools everywhere. So I'm racing against time. And I get this thing done just in time, about 20 minutes before dark. Started up. Purrs like a kitten. I am so excited. But of course, you can't feel the real power of all your cylinders firing unless you take it for a ride. So I didn't really have time to go back to my car and get my sweatshirt, so I sort of looked around and thought, I got time. So I popped the lines off, took this boat out, came around the breakwater, started to tap up the throttle, felt great. Wind in my hair, eyes were watering, it was getting cold. I was having those stupid man moments where I was like, all I really want to do is drive fast and go fishing. I'm trying to figure out how I didn't need a day job. Then I slammed down the throttle, and there was this horrible, horrible sound. Sounded like I'd run into a floating car in the water, and the boat came to a stop, and I turned off the key and I ran to the stern because I thought I was going to sink. I thought the outdrive had shot off the back of the boat. And it was pretty clear that the torque from the engine had sort of done something somewhere between the engine and the outdrive, and there was horrible, horrible banging. So I called the boat yard as I'm sitting there in my T-shirt floating around at 42 degrees on a Monday, which means there's nobody in the water. And I thought to myself, am I in trouble here? So I called and I had this conversation with not the mechanic, but the marketing guy. Started talking it through, and I was trying to get to the part where he comes and picks me up. And all he wanted to talk about was what was wrong with the engine. So I told him. I said, there's horrible sounds, obviously, in the outdrive and all this stuff. And I said, can I get a tow? Well, it's going to be a little while. You know, I'm sort of curious what's going on with your engine. I said, well, did you have a hunch? He said, oh, yeah. We've all been here before, right? This is where it goes. I don't know if you're aware, but they started putting ethanol in our gasoline. And I thought, you think it's ethanol that shattered the outdrive? I think so. I mean, I can't prove it, but I think so. Well, it turns out we didn't go back to that boatyard. They put on the manifold backwards, and all summer long we've been sucking water into the cylinders. And so that's the great thing about blaming ethanol for everything, because it perfectly disguises when you screw up. So we'd shifted boatyards, and putting on the manifold backwards is one thing, but blaming it on ethanol is quite another. So we shifted boatyard. So now I want to talk a little bit about the RFS. When we go up on Capitol Hill, if we're facing a problem of that magnitude, you can understand that the oil industry, which, and I have to tip my cap to them, the problem isn't Shell. It's who Shell pays to make sure that the blend wall is not solved. It's API and AFPM. And they go up on the hill and they try to spin the RFS as a failure. And we have to hit the reset button all the time. Because we start these conversations, and they inevitably say, you know, you got to admit, Brooke, or you got to admit, Bob, or you got to admit, Jeff, that this thing's broken in a number of places. Well, the truth is, the RFS 2 is only 5 years old. Cellulose is developed very quickly, actually. And the RFS 1 is just less than 10 years old. And from a development perspective, when you're innovating the cleanest fuel in the world, that's not a very long time. The other thing that's lost is the RFS is whole. So every gallon that has been required on the conventional side has been met and then some. On the advanced side, every gallon, we were 2 billion last year, 2.75 billion this year, has been met as well. The tension comes in, we're using more Brazilian ethanol and more biodiesel than we expected and less cellulose. And I'm not undercutting that puts a lot of pressure in the marketplace. I think everybody in this room feels that pressure. But before you talk about that pressure, it'd be helpful to remember that through a global recession, the RFS remains whole. Now, there's three things there at the bottom that have X's. Cellulosic biofuel needs to break through. There's no question about it. Ethanol markets are still constrained, and tax policy is still inequitable. And the oil industry, as I mentioned, does not like the RFS 2, and they're going after it. So I look at the world, and I'll just confess this, I look at the world through a government affairs lens. And of course, I have kids, so I also like bubbles. So this is what we see when we see the future of the RFS. This is what we see every single day. The strategy is take a whole bunch of different, we're in Vegas, poker chips. They don't add up individually necessarily to changing the RFS, but if you push them into the center of the table, you might be able to get the 60 votes that you need to open this thing up and gut it. And I think we need to look at what we see in the headlines every day as part and parcel of this strategy to change the RFS. So just yesterday there was a committee hearing that touched on the fact that we don't need the RFS because we now have all these new oil reserves. And of course we have some partners in the environmental space that are willing to go out and say biofuels are not really good for the environment because of land. Environmental Working Group said that we've expanded for corn use, the equivalent of Indiana, and we're worse than tar sands. We have biofuels that have unintended consequences, food versus fuel. We have cellulosic biofuels are not emerging. So if you think the RFS is actually okay for conventional, well, it's not really working for us, so we've got to get rid of it. And then the last one is perhaps underemphasized, but I'd like to emphasize it more, and that's that tax incentives for clean energy impede the free market. This is a big one. This is the one that underlies most of the stories that drive us all crazy in the Wall Street Journal. If the underlying belief is that we have a free market, and the RFS is imposing its will on that market, and all of the subsidies for clean energy are distorting the market, then the chorus is going to continue to be, well, geez, that's not the way the market should work. So we have to do a better job of going and explaining that there are a lack of competitive forces in the market, that if it was a price-driven market, everybody in here would be making more money and we'd be using more ethanol. We have to do that. We don't necessarily have to go after the oil companies and say, well, Shell's not telling the truth or API is not. We have to go and tell the truth about the market and tell the truth about the tax code. Last month, we endeavored to cover one piece of this. So we published a progress report, and you'll see in the bottom left-hand corner there, cellulosic biofuels, and I crossed out not and said are emerging. This map represents projects in roughly 20 states that we made an effort to go out and profile. We did not make an effort to go out and profile all of the cellulosic biofuel projects. And I should mention a few that are not on the map. It was really hard to get Italy on this map. And then, of course, Enerkem has a project being built in Edmonton, which actually lined up right in the middle of the AEC at the top, so I had to eliminate that star. But there's a lot of projects being developed. And one of the things we learned with this progress report that we perhaps didn't expect to learn is that when you put a spread out in front of people and you tell them about these projects and you tell them who the partners are and you tell them who where the loan guarantees came from and what the feedstock is and how much building is going on, even if it's 10, 12, 15, 20 plants, they start to focus on the path to commercial production, the investments that have been made in the wake of the RFS just 5 years ago, and they stop focusing on whether it's $2 billion or $3 billion or $5 billion in 2015, this sort of counterproductive debate about how much we're going to produce, and more about the fact that we are now breaking through a commercial scale with the most innovative and cleanest fuel in the world, and it's ethanol. And it's cleaner than anything else from a carbon perspective. So coastal Democrats in places like where I live in Massachusetts and where I used to live in California need to be more excited about it. And they need to listen to us about what we need to do to get it done. So how do we move this process forward? It's all about facilitation of the RFS. So the first one is don't be fooled. My understanding, and I am a conspiracy theorist, but my understanding is that the oil industry is making the rounds and talking to people about what they need out of an RFS amendment. Well, an RFS amendment right now is suicide, politically. It might sound good, but it's suicide. So John talked about changing the RFS. API has publicly come out and said they want to repeal the RFS. Repeal means the whole thing. So that if the trade associations are publicly saying it, you can imagine what Jim Inhofe is thinking and Coburn is thinking about what they will do if we have a conversation on the Hill about the RFS. Second bullet there is something that has emerged very strongly with the Advanced Ethanol Council. 2 years ago, we were focused mainly on tax and getting these plants built, getting risk down, getting the project finance done. We're still focused on that. But with increasing regularity, we're talking about market, where our ethanol is going to go, and our investors are having that conversation. So from my perspective, it's all in time on the ethanol blend wall. We need to go do the battle and get it done. My perspective is also that we're stronger together, changing that dynamic than we are apart. And by together, I mean both conventional and advanced. If our adversaries split us, whether it's the oil industry or environmental groups who seem to be stuck on this idea that there's good biofuels and bad biofuels, they're not paying attention to what the conventional biofuels industry is doing to innovate, what they're bolting on, some of the feedstocks that they're thinking about, some of the investments they're making. If they divide us, I don't think we have as good a chance to break the blend wall and actually make the case and create the political will that we need to create to knock this down. So I think we're better together. Third is reforming the federal tax code is absolutely critical. We are all trying to produce unconventional fuel. That's how EIA classifies it. We've got all this light sweet crude. It's either flat or declining. We're going and finding the new stuff. The new stuff might be a long ways under the sea. It might be a long ways under the sea in Alaska. It might be tar sands, but it also might be biofuels. And if you're asking someone to produce unconventional fuel out of biomass versus crude oil, they're going to run through a series of tests. And one of the tests is, what does the tax code tell me to do? And I want to read very quickly from the testimony of Harold Hamm. And Continental is one of the largest developers of the Bakken. I'm just going to read directly from his testimony last summer. In reference to 1986, which was sort of the last time they thought about these independent oil subs, he said, a bipartisan majority recognized the importance of leaving the tax provisions of the American independent oil and gas industry intact. This decision played a significant role in the technology-driven oil and gas renaissance we are currently experiencing. Without the current capital provisions, which is, I guess, what they're calling tax incentives, in place, we would not have been able to fail over and over again, which is what it took to advance the technology needed to produce the Bakken and numerous other resource plays across America. This paradigm shift in American oil and gas exploration brings with it high-paying jobs, increased tax revenues, economic growth, while lessening our dependence on foreign oil. He stole that from us. But it depends on substantial amounts of capital. The tax provisions that let us keep our own money to reinvest in drilling are crucial to keep this energy revival going. They have that stuff permanently.
We have some of that stuff, and it expires every year. We just got our PTC extended and our accelerated depreciation extended last year. We brought it back. It's a win, right? It was being attacked, and we stayed in the tax code for a broader conversation. It happens to also expire in 10 months. When investors see that in the tax code, they start looking at deep water rather than biomass. So in the spend, from a spending perspective, we're going to have a conversation. Nobody knows where it's going to go, but we have to get in and demand parity at least with incumbent energy industries moving forward. We also can't be complacent about any piece of this. Now, this I actually pulled from a presentation I did last year, and I'm now realizing that the font is kind of small. But this is the tug of war going on from a messaging perspective. The myth is that we're the high-cost solution, we're the subsidy-laden solution, we're the ones distorting the marketplace, and to fix it, you got to get rid of all this stuff. You got to get rid of VTEC, that distorted the marketplace. You got to get rid of loan guarantees for us, not them. You got to get rid of all these tax incentives. The reality is that we're none of those things. We're the clean, low-cost, not subsidized version. And we have to win this messaging war because, again, it is the underlying component of all these stories that we keep seeing over and over again. If you get your hands on these slides, what the top quote basically says is it's API or AFPM. I can't even see it. They're saying that we need to let the market work. We need to let the free market work, but with these tax incentives that Harold Hamm talks about to protect their risk and decrease their risk and protect their money. And then the other quote says, look, it's the global oil subsidy construct that is actually pushing investment away from renewables into fossil fuels. So this is what the world, I think, looks like if we do a good job. If we identify the problems, isolate them, build strategies around each one of them, the truth is on our side. And the truth is that it's because we have limited domestic resources that we need the RFS. The truth is that unconventional oil is not good for the environment. It's good that foreign oil dependence creates the massive economic and environmental consequences and has been openly called out for being a primary cause of the global recession and being the primary cause of us not recovering from it very quickly. Cellulose is emerging, and we need to reform the tax code to reflect 21st century energy goals. That doesn't mean be defensive about each one of these things. It means tell the truth about what's going on with each one of these things. And we have to do it. There's a lot of people watching. We talk about the blend wall. A lot of the solution lies in the hands of the auto industry. Some of these things are not expensive. The things that we need to blow this market open and drive us towards a marketplace that is price-driven and rewards innovation. But they also have to figure out what the heck is going on in a policy-driven space. And when they see the oil industry winning on these issues, they don't know what to do. Not that I would defend the Coleman's, not that I would defend the industry on that particular issue, but they have to be able to predict it. So we have to go and knock these things down in order to work to get where we want to go. Thank you.
We're going to round things out with Mark McMenemy with Guggenheim, giving a perspective from the investment community.
Jeff, where is the flip slides? Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you. All right. Well, thank you. It's great to be with you this morning in this amazing place. You know, I was thinking Las Vegas seems to me a little bit like a metaphor for the ethanol industry. If you think about it, from a very kind of unlikely and modest beginnings, you make a splash, you build something, and you float a lot of other boats along the way. And I kind of think that's what the ethanol industry has done. I'm Mark McMenemy, Director of Policy Research and Analysis for Agribusiness and Biofuels for Guggenheim Securities. First off, I want to take the opportunity to congratulate all of you for your part in raising this industry from one that supplied a niche product with a limited distribution footprint to one that supplies a major component of the gasoline supply from coast to coast today. I also want to commend you for having built up this association. From my perch in Washington, D.C., it seems to me the RFA does a terrific job of representing your interests. A few words about Guggenheim Securities. Our clients at Guggenheim Securities represent a broad spectrum, but my beat is mainly institutional investors consisting of pension funds, mutual funds, hedge funds, and sovereign wealth funds. So my job there is to interpret and advise these investors on Washington policy matters and to serve as a lookout, pointing out obstacles that are approaching and opportunities that may be on the horizon. So what does all that mean as concerns the renewable fuel standard? Well, a broad range of investors have a keen interest in the RFS, and I was trying to think of how am I going to represent institutional investors. I'm going to try this out as a profile. Yeah, they're all from Missouri. That's at least in my experience, and they all want to be shown. Some of these investors own securities in ethanol or biodiesel producers, but most probably do not. A much larger population of investors cares about the RFS because they own securities in companies that are affected indirectly, but often powerfully, by the RFS. And so these would include farm equipment manufacturers, fertilizer companies, seed developers, enzyme manufacturers, refiners, protein companies, and food manufacturers, to name just a few. It's a cliche, but it is also a truism to say that investors are averse to uncertainty. And here's where the RFS provides, I think, an interesting paradox. In a sense, there is no uncertainty within the RFS. The rising use schedule in the law established is clear through 2022, and it extends beyond that. No uncertainty there. And yet many investors continue to feel uneasy about the RFS. Why? It's no secret that a contingent of influential industries is determined to substantially alter, if not repeal, the RFS. And they have their champions in the Congress. The merry-go-round of attacks keeps the uncertainty alive, and it has a corrosive effect on confidence. For investors, Congress is the poster child for uncertainty. Witness its recent handling of the fiscal cliff, the debt limit, the budget sequester that now looms on March 1, and the coming expiration of spending authority at the end of March. Is it any wonder that every time one of these RFS bills is introduced, my phone starts ringing? Secondly, the drought has revived the food versus fuel argument. Whether legitimate or not, if we are so unfortunate as to have another poor crop this year, that argument may resonate more broadly and more profoundly. At least many investors fear that it could. Thirdly, petitions by states seeking a waiver of the RFS obligation for corn ethanol is unnerving for investors. Here I would add that after the second round of this exercise last year, investors appear to have gained a better understanding that the statutory bar for granting an RFS waiver is a high one and one that is not easily reached. And I think more investors are coming to the conclusion that a temporary waiver probably would not be a game changer for the ethanol industry. So on balance, the concern over waivers, I think, is diminishing. and perhaps most importantly, investors are having a hard time reconciling the rising consumption schedule in the renewable fuel standard with the blend barrier and with the outlook for little to no growth or even negative growth in gasoline use. And on this chart, you can see gasoline consumption is the blue line, horizontal line. The ethanol use is on the red line, and then the bars on the right-hand side would be the opportunity for corn ethanol under RFS2. If gasoline use is stagnant or even declining, if ethanol use has effectively reached the E10 blend wall, if E85 remains a niche product, if E15 is struggling to make inroads, and if cellulosic biofuels continues to be a next year commercial product, then investors wonder if the RFS schedule is realistic. And if it's not realistic, does that provide a viable argument for those seeking to alter it or even repeal it? We know there is administrative flexibility built into the RFS, and we know that there are workarounds that can be employed to avoid arriving at an unworkable situation. But investors increasingly want to see a clear pathway through the blend barrier. If you layer onto this mix the resistance to E15 among key stakeholders in the fuel supply chain, the complexity and the uncertainty over the future of the low-carbon fuel standard in California, and the opportunity provided by the boom in shale gas production and how that may play into the transportation fuel mix in the future, then uncertainty and concern about the durability of the RFS and about any threat to its integrity is magnified. Finally, know that the horizon for many large institutional investors is not more than 18 months. Often it's considerably shorter. This limits their tolerance for low visibility situations and makes near-term threats that much more acute. My bottom line to you is this. On balance, investors believe the RFS is an important backstop. And in general, I believe they would prefer less debate and more certainty around its future. I say on balance because I'm beginning to hear some investors assert that the ethanol industry, at least the corn ethanol industry, the corn starch ethanol industry, has reached the point where it could make its way without the RFS. I would not characterize this as the broadly held opinion, at least not yet. I think many investors would take what you might call a stand aside and wait and see approach if they became convinced the RFS was to be repealed, rolled back, or substantially altered. But it is a viewpoint I'm beginning to hear. As a final thought, I'll remind you of what you know. This industry, your industry, was carved out of adversity. It has always scaled a wall of doubt and skepticism and overcome it. You have my admiration for what you've accomplished and my thanks for the invitation today. I wish you a good conference.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate your comments. What I'd like to do now is just pose a few questions to some of the panelists that I was jotting down as each of them spoke. I thought all did an excellent job and raised some very important issues that I think we should have some further discussion on. And then following that, I'd be interested to hear your questions from the audience. But I wanted to start with John. On a point that Brooke made, kind of on the question of reforming versus repealing the RFS. You know, we've heard from several individual oil companies that, you know, we generally support the concept or basic structure of the RFS, but we want some fixes, we want some tweaks or some changes to this or that. But then on the other hand, you've got, you know, your associations, API and NPRA, saying, we don't want to tweak anything about this program. We want to kill it. So I'm just wondering, you know, is there a disconnect between the positions of the member companies of these trade groups and what the trade groups are saying on Capitol Hill?
Is this on? Okay. Trade associations work by consensus. I'm sure that's how RFA works too, right? Not everyone always agrees with all positions, and companies sometimes differ. Shell's view on the RFS revision, it was a minority view at API. API's position is to repeal. I think, though, what we certainly all agree on is the problem of the blend wall. It's we all understand the blend wall and see it as a problem. The question is, okay, so now what? And Shell's view is that we should revise the RFS because, you know, we do have interest in, you know, ethanol production, and also, you know, longer term, we're interested in, you know, the cellulosic biofuels as well.
Okay. Okay. My next question would be for Mark, following his remarks. You know, one comment that really caught my attention was your comment that there's a growing number of investors that believe the industry may be able to stand alone without an RFS in place. And I guess I'm interested to know why, or your perception of why they are believing that, or what is contributing to that belief. Certainly, we saw lots of analyses during the comment period for the temporary waiver that was proposed or petitioned for last year, and many of those analyses suggested, sure, you know, a 1 year, a 12-month waiver may not have much effect, if any, on ethanol production and consumption. But I think that's a much different question than what happens long-term without the RFS in place. So I'd be interested to hear a little more on kind of what you're hearing regarding that thought.
Sure, Jeff. Well, thank you for the question. I threw it in there. It's a question that, frankly, I'm starting to hear from institutional investors. I don't think it's the prevailing opinion yet, or, like I said, the broadly shared opinion, but I think it's one some people are starting to ask. They're saying, look, the infrastructure has been built out for this industry. The oil industry has accommodated to 13, 14, 15 billion gallons. And would all that really go away now? The blend stock has been changed to take advantage of the higher octane level. And would all that really go away now if the RFS wasn't there? So, again, I think the jury's still out on that question, but it is maybe surprisingly a comment that I'm starting to hear from a number of investors.
That's interesting.
Having said that, I think there would be a lot of concern and nervousness if that were actually to come to pass.
Okay. Thank you. Rick, a question for you. You referenced several times the limitation on the cap, 15 billion gallon cap for renewable fuel, which is the only portion of the RFS that cornstarch ethanol may qualify to fit in. So I'm wondering what new developments or what things are the corn growers thinking about in terms of tapping into that advanced biofuel piece of the RFS. You mentioned obviously corn stover and maybe corn fiber and some feedstocks like that as being opportunities. But I was just wondering if you could provide a little more perspective on what opportunities the corn industry sees in being part of that second tranche of the RFS.
We believe ever since the RFS was put in place that that language was arbitrary and wasn't based on science, and it's been an irritant that that cap was put there arbitrarily. However, as I said, job one for us is to get a crop and get back into a surplus position, or get back into a position where we have stocks in the pipelines and are not in a short crop position. So it's not something we would address or would consider addressing right now until we get that crop back in place. But in the longer run, we're very confident that production will exceed consumption of corn, and that we'll be in a surplus position. We'll need to be able to expand our uses. And we think that there are good sets of data and science available to show that corn can meet the 50% or the 60% reduction in greenhouse gases and could qualify based on science, create a pathway for cornstarch to be eligible to be an advanced biofuel if that arbitrary statement were taken out of the legislation. But again, first step now is to get a crop, get that in place, and that's our entire focus in 2013. We do see, you know, there's a little bit of irony that you can take a corn plant and the stalk, same plant, same input, same planting patterns, the stalk qualifies to be an advanced biofuel, the cob qualifies to be an advanced biofuel, the fiber out of the kernel perhaps can be an advanced biofuel, but the starch cannot. That doesn't make a lot of sense.
So, okay. All right. Thanks, Rick. Brooke, I want to turn to you. You know, this is obviously a panel about the RFS, but you spent a lot of time on tax policy and kind of the leveling the playing field in terms of tax policy. And I just wanted, and I know that's, you know, there are other discussions during the conference about that subject, but I wondered if you could just elaborate a little bit on what in particular mechanisms are necessary, you know, what things are AEC members talking about in terms of the right tax policy moving forward to be complementary with the RFS?
So thanks for the question. The issue that we really have is we have an RFS saying go north market, and we have a U.S. tax code saying go south. North meaning renewables, south being incumbent investments. And in order to align those two things, or to enable the RFS, we need to align tax with it. I think I made that point. I also referred to the decision-making process. And so the investment community looks at this stuff as provisions that de-risk or otherwise protect their investment. They lean on it to a greater degree in energy than they probably do elsewhere, because energy markets are basically not free. They're policy-driven. The U.S. government has been driving decision-making since the beginning of the last century in that area, and they're not price-driven. And when they're not price-driven, that makes the investor not really know how to invest 10 years from now, because they don't know if they build a better mousetrap whether it would sell. So they look at tax. And what they see, the big things that they see that they don't see parity on are percentage depletion, the ability to expense intangible drilling costs, a depreciation construct that we have that allows us to write off 50% of our costs in the first year. That exists in perpetuity in many other phases of the space. And then you have MLPs, which is a master limited partnership, which in essence allows a lot of folks in the oil industry that are trying to develop projects to access the retail investment marketplace through what amounts to an LLC rather than going through the SEC. And anybody that's dealt with the SEC versus an LLC knows it's a heck of a lot easier to have a meeting in an afternoon and create an LLC than it is to go through the SEC and go public. So I've heard a lot of people say, well, the MLPs, we don't really know how big a deal they are. It's a $220 billion a year pass-through in the tax code. 10% of it is for fuel production. 10% of $220 billion is a pretty big number and a lot bigger than what we get in the PTC. So we want to see some sort of discussion about correlating all of those three aspects. And there's a lot of different ways you can do it.
Okay. Thanks, Brooke. I have just one last question for the entire panel, and I guess I'd ask John to start. But this question has to do with the the inherent flexibilities of the RFS program, and that isn't something we got into much in any of our presentations. You know, again, we hear a common criticism coming from the obligated party community is this is an inflexible program. It doesn't have any wiggle room, and therefore, you know, we need to blow it up and start over, or we need to go to Congress to rewrite the program. I mean, we would obviously take a totally alternative view on that question. We think there is significant flexibility within the program, you know, via the annual rulemaking process that EPA has for RVOs. You know, they obviously adjust the cellulosic numbers, have done so each and every year so far. They have the ability to adjust the overall advanced biofuel standard. And, you know, technically they have the authority to adjust the overall RFS based on what the reduction of the advanced biofuel standard might be. So, I mean, we see tremendous administrative flexibility within the program that would obviate any need for congressional intervention. So I was just wondering if John, you could start by commenting on why you think, or not you personally, but why there's this notion out there that flexibility isn't enough to address some of the issues that you raised. And then I'd be interested in any thoughts the other panelists have about some of the finer points of you know, flexibility and what those really mean for your stakeholder groups.
Sure. I'm glad to. I'm very familiar with all of those provisions. Every year when EPA adjusts the cellulosic requirement, they are allowed to but not required to adjust the advanced in the general renewable. They have not done that to date. But I think it's going to be something that they're going to have to seriously consider going forward. But the issue with that is, if you look at the math, you still have the blend wall problem, okay? Because the volume levels go up. Even if cellulosic were zeroed out, I'm not suggesting that's what it should be, but even if it was zeroed out and you adjusted the advanced and general renewables anyways, you still have a blend wall problem based on gasoline demand in the United States. So I don't think that solves the problem. Actually, EPA was supposed to have done several years ago an overall readjustment of the schedule of the RFS. There's a provision in the law that says if EPA adjusts the cellulosic by 50% in any given year, or I think it's 20% in any two consecutive years, then they're required to adjust the overall schedule of the mandates. But it can't be effective until 2016. Well, they were supposed to do that rulemaking within a year of triggering that requirement, which would have been, I think, in 2010. They triggered it the very first year. They have not done that rulemaking. I think it would be a good idea if they did that. It'd give everybody a little bit more certainty of what the picture looked like. But here again, it can only be effective in 2016. The blend wall is here sooner than that. Okay, so that's not a solution. Although EPA ought to do that, and they ought to do it soon, but it's not going to solve this problem. And then EPA has authority to issue waivers if there's insufficient domestic supply or if the RFS is causing severe economic harm. I'm afraid that we're going to get to a point with the blend wall where that criteria is met, okay, and they could make an adjustment, but I still don't think it's going to solve the problem. It's likely to come when the problem is already visible, which is too late, I think. It'd be better to solve this problem before it becomes too obvious to everybody. And the other thing is they can only do it at a year at a time. So there's always the next year's RVO hanging over the obligated parties and uncertainty about whether or not EPA is going to adjust it for the next year. So I think then even if they adjust it on that that annual basis, that would provide some relief, but I don't think it's going to solve the problem. So that's, these are things that I've thought about quite a bit, and so, I kind of come down to, even with all of those flexibilities, I still think the actual law needs to be revised to address this issue. Thanks.
Okay.
Yeah.
Brooke?
Sorry, a couple things. I mean, let's start with the obvious. Obviously, the Doyle and Doyle trades don't want to talk about the flexibility in the RFS, because if you're going to Capitol Hill and you're saying this is an ill-conceived, obnoxious, thoughtless RFS that requires us to do all these terrible things with no flexibility, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to show up and say, actually, there's a whole bunch of flexibility and it's pretty sophisticated, and they alleviated 97% of our blending obligation in cellulose just this year and last year. So that's why we don't hear a lot about it, because it's just us saying it. On the advanced side, this is something that RFA and AEC have not agreed on. We don't agree on everything. We agree on most things. But in terms of why the advanced piece needs to be maintained to the degree that it is responsible to do so, is that when you're trying to innovate and you're having conversations with investors, what they want to know is that the government is committed and the certainty is there that we talked about here, and that ultimately we're going to do this. And then they go into what is otherwise a pretty risky space. And when the government says, well, we're not going to do this, we're going to do this other thing, they don't say, well, thank God, they're just going to adjust it once. They say, oh, God, here we go. And so we have to be careful about how we adjust those things, and that's the reason that the advanced biofuels industry is very, very touchy about both retroactive adjustments and adjustments to the advanced number. And we don't hold it against the conventional ethanol industry. We get it. We know that the RFS at the end of the day is supposed to promote renewable fuel, and we are trying to figure out how to do that. And so we've committed to a process and a dialogue with Bob and everybody else to try to get this done, because 2014 is going to be a pretty challenging year. Some of those numbers are going to be difficult, and we're going to try to create unity around that position moving forward. Last thing is, I think there's some buyer's remorse on the oil industry side, because the credit waiver program that Chris Hessler was about to ask a question that was involved in, and a number of other people were involved in, the oil industry supported that and wrote letters to the EPA and said, this is exactly right. We need to have these types of flexibility provisions. And now it's a little hard for me to read, in every newspaper it seems like I pick up, it says this is the most insane thing that's ever been invented by the EPA. The oil industry had the pen in a lot of ways, or one of the pens. And so maybe that we need to look inward a little bit.
Okay. Any other quick comments, or should we move to the floor for questions? Okay, I see several people lined up for questions out there, and if you have a question, please move to one of the microphones. We'll start right here in front with Chris.
Chris Hessler with AJW. John, as you pointed out, you and I have been talking about the program for a real long time, and it concerns me that the blend wall is keeping you up at night, so I want to see if we can work on that problem a little bit.
Appreciate that.
Yeah. Look, you, this seems to be your main argument for opening up the RFS, the blend wall. But you're not really appearing in your argument to take into account that we do have cars that are capable of using E15. We do have cars that are capable of taking E85. We have fleets of them that are out there. And so as the blend wall approaches, the principal economic dynamic that we're likely to see in the marketplace is that RINs will start to become more expensive, because they're in short supply relative to demand. That's what happens in short supply scenarios. So as a RIN becomes more expensive, a station owner has more incentive to sell high-concentrated versions of ethanol-based fuel. Why wouldn't they do that? Why wouldn't, in the places where it's viable, where you have a lot of vehicles, where you have access to fleets that can use E85, why wouldn't we see an increase in those sales? Because someone is going to make a killing on the RINs that they get to sell to you and to the other oil companies. It seems to me that if we let the market work, it might be a little messy at first, but we don't need the entire nation to be driving flex fuel vehicles in order to get through the blend wall. And that seems to be the premise of your concern, that unless we all have E85 vehicles, the whole market's going to freeze up and you guys are going to have to stop selling fuel.
So I can't argue with your logic about, when there's a tightness in supply of a market, there's usually an impact in the price, and that's what you would expect there as well. I think actually that's EPA ought to keep a pretty close eye on what's happening in the RIN market, because it's the first kind of canary in the coal mine that the blend wall is starting to unfold. I think the problem, though, is when you look at the math and the time that it would take, that can't happen in time to solve the blend wall. Even if you really expanded the number of stations to that offered E85, it just can't be done in the time frame. The blend wall is really here for some companies already right now. Okay. The thing about the blend wall, let me explain this a little bit, is different companies hit it at different times depending on whether you're a merchant refiner or whether you have downstream assets and things like that. And there's probably some companies already that have hit the blend wall and their only option really is to buy the RINs, and I think we're already seeing some of that impact. It spreads, and the problem also accelerates over time. And I just think our folks, I can't cite you the exact numbers and things like that, but the problem with your argument, I think, is that the timeline and the math just don't work to solve the problem in the time that it would have to be solved.
Okay, thank you. We'll go to the back microphone.
Hi, Monty Shaw from Iowa. Kind of goes right to the point you just made about the timeline. I have one comment and then a question. You threw out that it might cost as much as $40,000 or $200,000 to add, you said E15 or E85 to a station, and that's just way off. In Iowa, the vast majority of tanks are approved for E15, all the dispensers are, and so with, in some cases, zero additional investment a retailer can offer E15. That gets me to the question. You mentioned 97% of the gas stations are independently owned, but in Iowa, they're often branded. And we have retailers in Iowa that would like to offer E15, but their branded contracts do not allow that. So on one hand, we're complaining about we can't get E15 out in time to solve this issue. On the other hand, you're tying those independent retailers' hands. And I don't know if Shell does. I know of other major oil companies that have contracts, branded contracts in Iowa that specifically preclude that. So maybe Shell doesn't, but in general, the oil industry is tying those hands. And even in states that have a UL requirement, now both major dispenser manufacturers have very cheap upgrade kits for the pumps that represent maybe about 75% of the pumps out on the market. So I think we could move quite quickly. Your thoughts on the branded contracts not letting this happen?
I can't speak specifically about Iowa, but Shell, we do think that EPA was premature in approving the use of E15, and so we do not support the use of E15 at this time. We have the CRC studies that have indicated that there's an issue with cars as well, and also the automobile manufacturers don't support its use. So we have not supported the use of E15. But, just talking about the industry in general, there's, I think the majority of retail stations actually are not compatible with E15 or E85. And the numbers that I cited, the $40,000 to $200,000, those are those are average estimates that I've seen. And I think, if you're talking about a station that, would have to put in new dispensers and new tanks because they're not compatible with E15 and E85, I think that those kind of estimates are correct. Now, if there's a station who has equipment that's already compatible, that would be lower.
Okay, we probably have time for one more right here in the front.
Yeah, Howard Marks with the K Street Alternative Energy Strategies, formerly with the Department of Energy. My question is for Brooke. And Brooke, I know you put up on the screen that slide, very encouraging slide, with the new cellulosic and advanced biofuel biorefineries coming on stream. I was wondering if you might just elaborate a little bit more about the ones coming just over the horizon within the next, 24 to 36 months, the volume and who they'll be and feedstock, et cetera. Thank you.
So I'm gonna answer this very quickly because a lot of them are in the room and they can better represent themselves. But we have if you ask EPA, it's INEOS and CURE. They're going to go first. I think INEOS is here. CURE may be here. That's where they get the 14 million gallons for 2013 proposed. You have Abengoa, FiberRight adding gallons, Poet DSM adding gallons at the end of this year, early next year. And then you have a number of other projects, both in Canada with Enerkem and Beta Renewables in Italy. They're trying to do something in North Carolina. A number of other projects that are going to come online in the 2 or 3 years sort of from now forward. It'll depend a lot on policy, et cetera, but we can get you a book. We can get you a book, and it has all the details. Thanks, Howard.
It turns out we do have time for one more question, so we'll go to the rear microphone again.
I am Mike Bryan with BBI International. I just have a question for you, John. You seem to be the man of the hour this morning. Given the fact that the stated position of the Renewable Fuels Association and the ethanol industry in general is, as Bob stated this morning, don't mess with the RFS, and the stated position of the API, we want to repeal the RFS. I'm personally curious. The position that you stated with Shell, that if there were some revisions to the RFS, can this industry absolutely depend on Shell to stand behind the RFS if there were some revisions to that program, and or do you think we would have to be concerned that Shell would eventually just acquiesce to the other members of the API and bail on it? I'm curious about that.
Huh. Gosh, we make our own decisions, you know. And we've supported the RFS all along, and we are a producer of ethanol. We're interested in cellulosic ethanol. I think, though, the question you're asking about, you know, how would we feel about an RFS of the future, depends on what the RFS of a future is, right? It's got to be achievable. It's got to be compatible and consistent. The mandates have to be consistent with the ability of infrastructure and vehicles to consume the fuel. I think that's a really critical aspect to really fixing this for going forward. But, you know, if it is a achievable, workable program, I think that we continue to support it, just as we have in the past. I mean, we've supported the concept in the past, even though we've seen the problems in trying to fix it. So hope that's helpful to you.
Okay, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the session this morning. I'm sorry if you weren't able to ask your question, but I would think that the panelists might be hanging around up front for a little while if you want to come up and chat with them. So thanks again for listening attentively, and please join me in thanking our panel again. And we're now scheduled for a 30-minute break.